Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Since the early 1920s, the Alberta Research Council has led the way in developing new technology for Alberta industry. This week, President John McDougall joins an enthusiastic crowd in Fort McMurray to present the annual review for the Research Council. And the Emerald Awards for Environmental Excellence were announced last week in Calgary. This year, two winners took home emeralds in the category of research and innovation. Accepting the awards were Dr. Jay Wusseri, leader of the Alberta Research Council's Native Seed Program, and Dr. Gary Scrimgeour of the Alberta Conservation Association for the Northern Watershed Study. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. It's time once again for the annual review at the Alberta Research Council. This week, the ARC will release its evaluation in Fort McMurray. Over the last year, the Council has undertaken an extensive restructuring and fine-tuning. It's an exercise that President John McDougall believes will help the Alberta Research Council optimize its position in what he calls the middle space, that place where ideas move towards market potential.
Well, one of the things that we've learned is that the time to application is kind of what determines who plays where. So if you think about the discovery side, which universities do very well, they attract these very sort of creative, independent thinkers, and they're an excellent source of ideas. And I think historically, if you look at Canada, you'll find that we generate more than our fair share of ideas. Industry, on the other hand, is looking to ensure that what they do is cost effective and that meets the quality standards and it's done in a timely way and so on. So they have a kind of a different driver, and they're very short term because in order for them to invest, they have to be able to see that they're going to get their money back in some kind of a timely way. So what that typically means is that the discovery activity tends to operate in a 10 to 20 year plus horizon. It takes that amount of time before those ideas typically convert into practical application. Industry wants a horizon that's maybe 2 years, perhaps three, but certainly not much more than that. Now, what you'll notice is there's a space, and that's the 2 to 10 year space. That's where ideas need to be picked up and converted into marketable products and services, often that industry does not yet see the need for, or perhaps hasn't quite identified the need for. So our job, organizations like us, if you like, have to be able to look at industry and be driven by the marketplace, but be able to be smart enough to anticipate what their needs are, and then have, in a market sense, and then have the scientific wherewithal to be able to mine the discovery places for those ideas and then say, aha, we could solve that problem by putting together this package of technology into this kind of solution. Now, that's this middle space, and that's the critical space. Now, if you talk about IT, organizations like us aren't required because that whole time horizon collapses down to perhaps 18 months from the time that somebody discovers how to do something with a computer to the time that you actually make a product out of it. But if you're talking about biotechnology or about advanced materials or about new processes or systems for recovering oil or whatever, that's where you tend to desperately need organizations like ourselves. So you have to understand what sector you're playing in, but if you do and you understand this time horizon as well, then you really start to understand innovation.
It all takes money, though. Where's the money going to come from?
Well, actually, the governments, to a large extent, have bellied up to the bar and are pumping, for the most part, adequate funds. Now, where additional support is still required, I think, is with some infrastructure in this mid-space. Because part of what we provide is specialty facilities. Once we have the facilities, companies will actually pay for them. They cannot themselves afford to front the capital, but they can certainly afford to pay to use it. And so it's not as though we're simply asking for public money, and it will start to cycle around, and an industry will pay for it. We've seen that in our own growth. When we began this process to sort of clearly occupy this ground, five out of every $6 came from the government. Now we're roughly twice as large, and less than half of our funding comes from government. So we've about tripled the industry participation over 5 years. So it tells you that if you're doing the things that they feel are important, they'll in fact come to the table.
What are some of the areas that you're focusing on then?
Well, we've really come to the point where we deliver in two major areas. That's life sciences and energy. Associated with that, we have what we call integrated resource management, which means really doing that kind of work in a sustainable way. So we provide support for that. We have an area that focuses on enabling technologies that are used by energy, life sciences, and the environment, things like sensors and materials and IT and this sort of thing. And then even more, I think, importantly, we now have a new ventures group which tries to take ideas and package them together and basically build the market-ready or near-market-ready products and processes that can be transferred then to industrial or government users.
What would you consider the highlights of this year? What would be the products that have come out of some of these areas?
Well, this year, I guess the real highlights are not so much new products, although we've got some really exciting things that are getting near, and I'll mention a couple of them. But the real excitement for us this year is essentially coming to grips with how to best contribute in this space and make sure that we use our resources as effectively and efficiently as we can. So we've been talking a lot about sustainable business in the innovation space, and so we've moved some previous activities out of ARC into the private sector because it was at a stage where that made more sense. We have stopped doing some things that weren't clearly aligned with our focus areas. We've begun to do business in different ways that's more cost-effective and so on. So we've done a lot of what I would call fundamental business rejigging in the past year that was very important. On the technology side, some of the exciting things that are happening, we have what we call the integrated manure utilization system, which, notwithstanding the challenges that the beef industry are facing in the short term, will be very important to help them develop in the long term. It basically takes the waste from these large feedlots, turns it into power and fertilizer and chemicals and so on, and actually takes waste and makes it another value-added commodity for the feedlot operator. So we're very excited about that. That's in near final stages of commercial development. We've also got a new fuel cell concept that's very small, although your listeners can't see it. If they can imagine a drinking straw, that's about the size of it, and it actually powers a fan. So by putting a couple of these things together, ultimately we hope we'll be able to drive computers and so on with it, with very interesting technology. That's very exciting.
What's ahead for the Research Council?
Well, if I speculate, our own dream is we want to be the best, certainly in Canada, in this innovation space where we convert ideas to market-ready products and services. And what we can start to see now is that the rest of the country is beginning to understand this need very clearly. We are today probably the largest organization of our kind in the country. So to me, that suggests we've got a huge opportunity to take advantage of and could very easily, as a result of that, see Alberta become ultimately the place where that kind of thinking is focused and is strongest. So that, for both the ARC and the province, ends up being very positive, I think.
Thank you, John.
Very welcome, Cheryl.
That was John McDougall,
president of the Alberta Research Council. The ARC presents its annual report this week in Fort McMurray. One of the important long-term projects for the Alberta Research Council has been developing its native seeds program. Every year in Alberta, millions of hectares are stripped to make way for roads and other developments. Not only must the soil be reclaimed when the construction is done, so must the plants. However, what's reseeded is generally not what's native to the region, and these replacement plants become invasive weeds that choke out what should be growing there. At this year's Emerald Awards for Environmental Excellence, plant scientist Dr. Jay Wusseri and his team were recognized for their work at the Alberta Research Council to develop a line of native seeds for reclamation. To say the least, it's been a long and arduous task.
And for most species which is not available, we start with a seed collection, and then we try to grow the species in plant nurseries and then evaluate the seed production potential. And we try to develop it into a variety because we want to maintain a certain quality. And when you buy a certified seed from a seed company, you are assured of quality of germination, purity, and that the seed is going to perform the way it's supposed to perform compared to buying a common seed. And basically, we look at characteristics like plant suitability for mechanizing harvesting, plant adaptation, plant disease problems, whether we are disease susceptible or resistant, because we have seen varieties which are brought in into this area at times can be more susceptible to diseases, and of course that's not desirable. And we look at adaptation, plant vigor, and can the plant provide a sustainable cover in the future, so this way there will be less maintenance to do.
We were just looking at some pictures of the different sites that you've been working on, and what really struck me is that when it comes to the seeds, it's not a case of one size fits all. You have such a diversity of sites to deal with. What are some of the conditions like that you have to try and fit all of this plant material into?
Usually we try to work within a ecoregion approach, and then still within each ecoregion, you have different landforms, whether it's a saline area, it's a sandy soils area, it's a south-facing slope, or it's a wetter areas where you have more water. So you have to identify which species within that landform, and then we do a seed collection based on that. And once we identify those species, we do the seed collection, then we proceed with a natural steps in seed production, like the basic evaluation, adaptation, seed production, plant vigor, and so on. But first, we have to identify what are the various species associated with the different landforms in that landscape. And we try to work at the landscape approach because this way you can have a better appreciation of the type of problem you're going to face. Like, does the plant fit into that landscape? Is it going to perform? And we also do what we call the multi-environment testing, where we take the species back into its environment where it was collected, where the disturbances is, and try to have a species established there, like on a smaller scale, try to see, like, okay, the species originated from that area. Now that we produce it, how do we reestablish it back into its communities again? And that sometimes can be a challenge because you're working with a different stress environment, like whether it's soils or climate. So it's a matter of, trying to find the right approach to have a seed establishment underway.
Now that you're trying to use native seeds that are appropriate to the different sites, yeah, is there enough seed around?
No, that's the question. People always ask us, where do we get the seeds? And of course, it took us about more than 10 years to come up with 9 varieties. Working with native species, it is a slow process. We don't get a seed crop the same year. We usually get a seed crop in the second year. So our goal is eventually to have enough species out there so that people can have a variety of species, you know, to use in reclamation. But again, like we're trying to come up with about, on average, we're about, you know, two varieties a year, which I think is pretty amazing. But over the next 5 years, we'll release another five varieties. But it's coming slowly, and as we move along and more species will be coming along, not only grasses, but we're also working on the flowers, native wildflowers. As you may be aware that the native wildflowers, not native, but the wildflowers, which is sold at our superstore or on our market, it's not really native. Like if they came from Europe or from California, and they're not really native as we think of the word native. So we're trying to come up with different species which are native to Alberta and which can also be used in naturalization project, in landscaping, and at the same time as a self-sustaining plant cover, low-maintenance alternative to the homeowners or to the landscape industry.
Where are you growing these seeds? Where are you producing them? Are you producing them here in Vegreville, or do you have to go elsewhere?
All our seeds are produced in Vegreville on site here. And once we are close to seed production level, like we are sure that, you know, we have enough seeds. And when we seek a partnership with seed company, and interested companies will partner with us, and we'll provide them foundation seed, like breeder seed, and they will multiply the seeds and develop foundation and certified seed, which they will in turn sell to the public.
What are some of the varieties that you're working with?
Well, we produced nine varieties before, and those include the slender wheatgrass, the broad-gloom wheatgrass, the own wheatgrass, the Rocky Mountain fescue, the Alpine fescue, the June grass, the spiked ricetum. We are now working with Canada wild rye, Canada milk vetch, Indian rice grass, sand drop seed, Canada sand reed grass, and some legumes like Northern sweet vetch, and nodding broom, and some of the flowers such as prairie cornflower, prairie tufted aster, blue flax, and evening primrose. Those are just a few of examples, like the diverse species we're working with. We're also working on some of the shrubs such as low bush cranberry, high bush cranberry, bayberry, and blueberry. Like, you know, those are valuable shrubs for the boreal forest, which we are going to start working on that again this year.
This isn't the sort of thing that happens overnight. How long have you actually been working on this project?
I myself, I've been working on that project since 1987, which is about 16 years.
Thank you very much, Jay.
You are very welcome. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Jay Wusseri, a plant scientist at the Alberta Research Council and project leader of the Native Seeds Program. This project won an Emerald Award for Environmental Excellence in the Research and Innovation category. Another project which also won an Emerald Award for Environmental Excellence in Research and Innovation was the Northern Watershed Study. The four-year study involved partners from the oil and gas sector, forest industry, Alberta Research Council, and was led by the Alberta Conservation Association. The study looked at three watersheds in northwestern Alberta that had varying levels of industrial development, the Nadakewan, Simonette, and Kakwa. 2 years ago, I joined fish biologist Dr. Gary Scrimgeour in the most pristine area, the Kakwa, as the researchers took fish census and looked for hanging culverts and blockages to fish passage. With the study now finished, I spoke with Gary about the final results of the Northern Watershed Study.
The focal questions around riparian forest management address issues of what are we doing in terms of managing riparian forests, what other jurisdictions are also doing. And the other two components are focused on where do we find fish, what are the impacts of current levels of activity, and is there a need to evaluate current practices to reduce those impacts.
Now, when I was up in that Kakwa area with you a couple of years ago, we spent some time going into the rivers, doing some electrofishing and seeing what was coming out of there. Now that the study is pretty well wrapped up, what are the things that you found?
The results varied between the three study components. The riparian forest work largely suggested that Alberta's riparian buffer guidelines are generally similar to other jurisdictions such as in the United States or in Europe, with the exception that Alberta tends to have relatively small buffers where forest harvesting cannot occur within very small streams. Otherwise, the guidelines are very comparable. In terms of some of the stream fish work, our data indicated that there are detectable cumulative effects of current levels of industrial development. Some fish species appear to increase in abundance, and others tend to decrease with industrial activity, but it's very species specific.
What might be those species?
The species that appeared to be most impacted by current activities are bull trout. They are very much a habitat specialist. We know that the work from the United States suggests that they don't do very well with activities such as roads or forest harvesting. And while the mechanism of why they don't do well is not well understood, our results confirm what other studies have found. Industrial activities, at least the current levels, don't bode well for bull trout, at least in northern Alberta.
Is that related to increased access?
That's a good question. It could result from many things. It could be that when we put in roads and seismic lines that we're providing anglers with increased access. So that's one way that it could affect them. It also could be a reduction in the quality of habitat. When we put in roads, we also tend to introduce nutrients and sediments, and that can reduce the habitat quality for bull trout. And also when we manipulate vegetation cover by forest harvesting, we also change the hydrology of the system, and that can also influence the abundance and quality of habitat.
What other things have you found?
Probably one of the most surprising results from the cumulative effects work were that bull trout were actually impacted by relatively low levels of disturbance. And that's a bit of a surprise. They tend to be very broadly distributed, but even very low levels of watershed activities for harvesting and construction of roads or seismic, even at what most people would consider to be very low levels, we're indeed having detectable impacts. And that would probably suggest that we need to step back now and understand what levels might be acceptable in terms of accommodating bull trout and levels that may not be.
What do you think accounts for their sensitivity or their vulnerability?
Bull trout actually belong to a group of fishes called char, and they are, as a group, rather habitat specialists. They tend to prefer very clear, cold water streams with lots of dissolved oxygen. We also know that they're highly vulnerable to angling. They're an incredible predator, really. So many aspects of their biology make them rather vulnerable to a suite of human impacts.
What other things did you find?
Back to some of the riparian work. Some of Phil Lee's work showed that, in fact, natural disturbances such as fire actually do influence riparian forests. And the main management paradigm, at least in Alberta, that's being evaluated is the extent to which we can develop harvesting regimes that mimic or approximate those produced by fire. One of the things we haven't known is really the extent to which fires influence riparian forests and whether we can mimic or approximate those in terms of harvesting practices. The information from that study was very useful because it provides us information on what the natural pattern appears to look like. We can then go ahead and evaluate alternative forest practices that can approximate those.
You've got a picture behind me where you're holding a bull trout, and in the background is this huge log jam or log pile. What's the significance of that to what might happen in the Kakwa when industrial development goes ahead?
The really interesting thing with adult bull trout is that they tend to prefer very deep pool habitats. And the work from the United States, as well as what we're seeing, is that these very large deep pools are actually created and maintained by very large amounts of woody debris. And the woody debris originates from riparian buffer areas. It enters the river, that's moved and transported and deposited downstream, and that these accumulations create the pools that the bull trout require. The question we have is, to what extent will forest harvesting within the riparian areas influence the delivery of these very large trees that maintain adult bull trout habitat?
Except it might not be there, will it?
It's possible that the woody debris accumulations may be a little more transient, and it's also possible, especially from some of the results from the United States, where in fact the occurrence of these large debris accumulations decreases, and that's accompanied with a reduction in adult bull trout. So you're changing adult habitat, and there are fewer adults to reproduce, which changes population growth through recruitment.
Any final thoughts?
I think when you initiate a project like the Northern Watershed Project, you truly hope that there will be an increased level of understanding. And I think that was something that we did see, getting together representatives from the federal and provincial government, from the oil and gas and forestry sector, and from conservation organizations is hugely beneficial, because they start to truly appreciate a diversity of perspectives. So developing this multi-stakeholder approach was wonderfully productive, especially over a four-year period where people truly learned from each other. And I think that this approach, where you get a diversity of stakeholders together, you allow them to struggle with the questions to truly influence the direction of the study, is absolutely crucial, because the solutions need to come from government and industry and conservation organizations. And I think when you do that, the solutions are more relevant, and they have a higher probability of actually being implemented, because people are truly engaged in what the process was, they understand the implications of the work, and then together they can find solutions.
Thank you very much, Gary.
You're very welcome.
That was Dr. Gary Scrimgeour, Manager of Science and Research for the Alberta Conservation Association. The ACA recently won an Emerald Award for Environmental Excellence in the category of Research and Innovation for its work on the Northern Watershed Study. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Research Council, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, the Capital Region Innovation Centre, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.